The meeting is back in session. Directors are all in their seats. Those that are in attendance, we can move on to item six, approval of the consent calendar. There are four items on the consent calendar tonight. Do I have a motion for approval of consent calendar? Motion by Director Cooper. We'll turn your microphone on first.
Hello, I'd like to pull 6.2 off the consent calendar.
Which item?
6.2. I don't believe it was supposed to be on the consent calendar. I thought the engineering committee said it should be presented.
All right, 6.2 has been pulled from the consent calendar. We have a motion for approval of consent calendar with item 6.2 pulled.
One more thing, President Martin. Item 6.3, I don't want to pull it. I just have one quick question for Ms. Patterson. So looking at board packet page 65, 37 of policies, rules, and regulations regarding the opt-out fee, you know, being a transplant to Santa Clarita, and my apologies for not getting to you before the board meeting, did not have time, but being a transplant to Santa Clarita, buying a house, you know, it's up to the seller of the property to state any issues or any opt-outs to the potential buyer. Now, that can be easily missed by any buyer. I would probably definitely miss it in this copious amounts of paperwork that we get. When property changes hands and we have the same account, but a different owner. Let me reverse back. Will the new buyer know of the opt-out feature, or will the agency know of the opt-out feature of the new buyer? Will the agency know the property has changed hands? How about that? Let's start that.
I'm passing this over to Kathleen. She's our customer service manager.
Okay. Thank you. So you got to wait this time.
So the agency does not track ownership of property, only account status. But to answer where I think you're going with this is if an account changes, if a service changes account ownership. So if someone moves out, moves in, then the opt-out would not follow the service. It only follows the customer. So, in other words, to probably make this a little bit more clearer, if a customer moves out of the area, takes service out of the name, their name, the new customer would not necessarily be notified that they're receiving an AMI meter because it will be the standard of service.
Okay. So the new new buyer will not be issued an opt out fee because that just follows the previous owner.
No, that's correct. You are correct.
Okay, I just wanted to verify that. Thank you. There's more.
Yes. Yeah, so to clarify, if a customer chooses to opt out and is charged the appropriate fees, monthly service fee, administrative fee. And moves out of the service area, the meter would automatically be upgraded to an AMI meter. The new customer would receive service from an AMI meter, would not be charged any additional fees because that would be considered the standard of service.
Okay, understood. Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome.
Back to you, President Martin.
Very good. So we still need a motion or correct the motion on the pulling item 6.2 from the consent calendar.
I move approval of the consent calendar with the exception of 6.2.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion before we move on to the pulled item? Do we have any public comment on item six consent calendar?
One second. We do not.
Very good. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll for Consent calendar with item 6.2 pulled.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Vice President Orzechowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
The consent calendar is approved, excluding item 6.2.
Right. Item 6.2, which was pulled from consent, approve a purchase order to Civil Tech Engineering, Inc. for change order number one for the final design services for the new Dean Zone tank at Sand Canyon Plaza. Design pre-stressed concrete tank instead of a welded steel tank. I have a feeling the presenter is Courtney Mayo. Go ahead, Mr. Mayo.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm assuming Orlando Moreno will present if he is online, but I wanted to clarify first that this item can get a little confusing with the other items we have of similar nature where we're doing participation in the Dean Zone specifically. On Thursday at the last ENO meeting, we talked about the Dean Zone and a participation in a construction contract to build recycled water or potable water tank in participation with that developer. That one was requested to have a full presentation to the board. At the prior ENO committee, almost a month ago, we did discuss this design change, and it's a small cost change order just for the construction. So I believe there's some confusion between the two projects.
Yep, you're right. Thank you.
Okay. May I ask a question? When you go through these things at engineering committee, because I don't monitor it, you get a full quote and compare it to probably an engineering estimate that you've come up with in advance?
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
So Director, I don't know, Cooper, if you want to continue with a full presentation, but this was recommended by the engineering committee to be on consent.
Sorry, Courtney. Director Cooper.
Would move adoption of item 6.2.
And I'll second it. And thank you for clarifying that, Courtney. I did think it was the big one.
No problem. All right. We will present on that.
Okay.
We have any public comment, April, on 6.2?
We do not.
Very good. Will you please call the roll?
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Vice President Orzechowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass.
Very good. We'll move to item 7, action items for approval. Unless Manager Stone wants to say any opening remarks, we'll just move on to item 7.1. We're good to go. I guess got the hand sign. Presenter tonight for item 7.2 is Rochelle Patterson. The item is approved, completing a letter of interest form for the EPA's WIFIA program. Ms. Patterson.
Okay, this item is to receive approval from the Board of Directors to submit a letter of interest for the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, also known as WIFIA. This is a low interest federal credit program administered by the EPA. Meeting with us tonight remotely, I hope, are the agency's municipal advisors, Laura Carpenter and Robert Poor, from the firm Fieldman Rollup, to describe the WIFIA program in more detail.
Great. Thank you very much, Rochelle. We prepared a presentation for tonight's discussion with the board. So if we can pull that presentation onto the screen, we can go in and get started. But in the meantime, to provide a brief overview of the item before the board today, it's really to provide feedback on a potential loan program that can provide an opportunity to acquire potential funding needs and capital funding opportunities for the agency's current long-term 10-year capital improvement program. Our understanding is this 10-year CIP program can cost and may cost up to $780 million, and that's in combination of both potential debt-funded and PAYGO-funded capital projects. We went to the Finance Committee last month and provided a detailed presentation on this type of loan funding that is an opportunity for any municipalities who are looking for water and wastewater infrastructure needs. Late last year, we actually had an educational presentation to both the board and the committee to discuss what opportunities an agency like yourself has to fund these types of capital long-term and large infrastructure needs. Some of those funding types can include PAYGO needs, on incoming rates from ratepayers, as well as long-term debt funding for appropriate and applicable capital projects, where it may be more economic to fund those projects over a long-term debt financing, where you can spread those costs over a long useful life and have those equal payments paid over multiple generations. Those types of long-term debt financing can include not only public financing debt or private financing debt opportunities, but also governmental loans. And today's discussion will be to discuss the WIFIA loan, also known as the Water Infrastructure Finance Innovation Act, that was enacted back in 2017. I'll pause here and ask April if there is the presentation available.
Give me just one moment to pull it up.
No problem. In addition, I can go ahead and start discussing one of the overview topics for the WIFIA loan program itself. The acronym WIFIA, starting here on slide 3, stands for Water Infrastructure and Finance Innovation Act. It was created back in 2017 by the Environmental Protection Agency. And it was created for agencies such as yourself who are looking to fund long-term water and wastewater infrastructure capital projects.
Hold on just a moment, Lori.
Of course.
Director Planbeck, I think your microphone is on.
No, it's not. Oh, this.
I tried to whisper. While we were at a golf match.
Sorry, we're having some IT issues. It'll just be a moment.
Great. So starting here on slide 3, we've provided a brief background again on what exactly the WIFIA Loan Act is, and again, created, as I noted before, by the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA. What we have located here is what has actually been informed or closed to date. So since its enactment in 2017, the WIFIA program has closed almost 89 loans, totaling approximately $15.4 billion in credit assistance for those eligible and applicable water and wastewater infrastructure projects. And because of the assistance, credit assistance that the program can provide, those closed loans have helped to finance almost $33 billion in infrastructure projects across the nation. The chart or the table to the right shows the nation and all the states that have provided or requested loans through the WIFIA program. Since its enactment in 2017, WIFIA has selected almost 192 projects to apply to the WIFIA loan, which can and which has been estimated to fund nearly $30 billion in infrastructure needs. So far, quite a successful program and an opportunity for the agency to utilize for its current funding round. We have another slide coming up in the slides to come that discusses what exactly the WIFIA program is offering for its federal fiscal year 2022, which we're looking at and hoping to get approval from the agency's board to submit its letter of interest. One key term that is very important to understand through the WIFIA loan program is that it can only fund up to 49% of eligible project costs. However, they do allow multiple funding sources to be combined with their WIFIA loan. So the 51% remaining project cost share can come from not only agencies' cash reserves, PAYGO funds from existing ratepayers, but also through other long-term debt opportunities or even other governmental loans, such as a state revolving fund loan funded through the State Water Resources Control Board. Next slide, please. This provides some key updates and bullet points of the benefits that the WIFIA loan program provides to its borrowers, the first of which is the actual interest rate. At closing, EPA provides one fixed interest rate for the entire term of the loan that is based off of the weighted average life of the loan plus a credit spread of 0.01%. What is very important about this credit spread is that in comparison to a public transaction, such as the one that the agency went through in 2020, a borrower's credit rating directly impacts the potential credit spread that can be offered in the market and, and the type of demand that bondholders might require. However, for the EPA's sake, your rating is not going to be, or your rating does not get impacted by the interest rate of the loan. For example, if you have two agencies who are closing on the exact same day with two separate interest rates, two separate credit ratings, the actual loan itself and the interest rate provided will be exactly the same if the weighted average life of those two loans is identical. So the 0.01% is the only additional credit spread that would be offered by the EPA, again, based off the weighted average life. The EPA only requires that a borrower be investment grade rating, which is met already by the agency's existing and outstanding ratings on its outstanding bonds through Fitch and S&P. What we've then identified below here on the slide is bullet points of additional flexible financial terms that provides additional benefits for an agency looking to borrow through the WIFIA loan program. First of which being they do allow customized repayment schedules. As the agency is aware, you currently have outstanding approximately $33 million of annual debt service costs. Instead of the requirement that the State Water Resources Control Board has of requiring level debt service, the WIFIA loan schedule can be amortized and can be structured along with its outstanding debt opportunities or outstanding debt obligations to provide a level overall basis structure and to hopefully provide less of a burden to the ratepayers for ongoing or new potential debt service costs. In addition, they provide a term that allows a borrower to repay the loan over a 35-year period starting after substantial completion of the project. For example, if an agency has a 3-year construction schedule, there will be no payments made during that 3 years of construction, and the repayment of the debt will start after that completion of the project occurs after the 3-year construction window. If the agency so chooses, or if the borrower requests and gets approved by the EPA, you are allowed to additionally defer your payments for another 5 years after substantial completion of the project. Again, as long as your final term of the loan does not extend past 35 years after completion of the project. To put that in perspective, a typical bond issuance in the public market usually goes out for about 30 years. That's a standard term for a long, useful life of a capital project. And a public bond issuance usually has a lockout period of approximately a 10-year call date. So typical agencies who issue in the public market will have to wait around 10 years before they have an opportunity to refinance or restructure the debt with lower interest rates. EPA, on the other hand, allows their borrowers to repay or to prepay portions of the loan on an annual basis once a year with minimum requirements of about $1 million prepayment. That is a very strong feature, one that is very hard to quantify, and as you can see from comparison to public market, is a very beneficial opportunity where the agency can utilize existing funds on hand or future cash that is set aside in reserves to prepay portions of an outstanding WIFIA loan if it's economic to do so. In addition, as I mentioned before, this program can be structured to be combined with other outside funding sources, grants, cash on hand, or long-term debt issuances and governmental loans to fully fund 100% of the project needs due to the requirement that only 49% must come from the EPA. Another important classification or term to keep in mind is if an agency is to utilize the WIFIA loan funding, there is a cap of 80% of total project funds or project costs must be or cannot exceed 80% for federal involvement. So if the agency is successful in obtaining 49% from the EPA, they would have 31% of additional funding needs that can come from federal grant programs or other federal loans of that nature. However, the state revolving fund loan is not classified as a federal loan, governmental loan program, which is why EPA does allow it to use if there is an opportunity to acquire state loan funding for the full 51% of the outside funding sources. And lastly, an additional benefit of the program is the EPA does allow an agency to subordinate its loan repayments. What that would mean is it would be paid second to any senior lien debt obligations. And this is different from the state revolving fund loan, which does require any new issuances to be on its most senior and parity lien structure. So that type of circumstance is also offered, and if approved by EPA, can be another opportunity or alternative to be utilized by certain borrowers if it's economic to do so. Next slide, please. So the board might be asking, why is this topic being brought today and why now? The EPA has opened up its 2022 federal fiscal year round of funding starting today, September 6th. They are receiving on a rolling basis new letters of interest submissions for their current funding eligibility of up to $5.5 billion, which can support up to $11 billion in water infrastructure investments. They will continue to receive letter of interest on a rolling basis up until their current funding has been exhausted or until they issue a new notice of funding availability for an upcoming or a subsequent federal fiscal year. So this is a great opportunity for the agency to take a look at its long-term capital improvement projects and identify out of those projects what really will be eligible under the WIFIA loan program and allows you to take a holistic view, apply early, and get into this current funding round. Once the EPA receives a letter of interest, it takes about an eight-week period to review that letter of interest before determining whether or not it will invite a borrower to continue to apply to receive funding from the WIFIA loan. On the bottom portion of this screen, we have identified some other key features and priorities of projects that are being looked at by EPA, in addition to the types of projects that are eligible for the WIFIA loan. What EPA is currently looking for in 2022 is projects that can remove lead in drinking water wastewater systems and projects that address any PFAS or emerging contaminants, which we understand is one of the high priority projects in the agency's current 10-year capital improvement program. And they're also looking for any projects that can support innovative and new approaches and address impacts of climate change or help and increase investment in any economically or disadvantaged stressed communities. In terms of identifying what types of capital projects can be funded with WIFIA loan, one key feature is any kind of projects that are eligible under the Clean Water or the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Loan is also eligible here for the WIFIA loan program. In addition to those projects, EPA does allow funding for energy efficient programs, desalination projects, acquisition of property, and anything relating to drought prevention, reduction, or recycling projects. The last bullet point here on the bottom of the screen is really a high point that we think makes the agency a great candidate. EPA will allow a borrower to fund a combination of multiple projects over a long period, such as the 10-year CIP the agency has, if such projects are secured by a pledge under or secured by identical pledge, which the agency's current revenue stream would be securing all of its CIP going forward in that 10-year program. This individual funding round is additional opportunity to provide what is called or to apply for a master agreement, which really goes into this last structure of utilizing a combination of projects to request from EPA in order to fund 49% of a large program of needs. The last item that we did want to address here on this slide is for applying for the WIFIA program, the agency will have to meet federal cross-cutter provisions. And those include, as stated here, NEPA provisions, Davis Beacon, American Iron Steel, and Build America, Buy America Act. What is important to note as well, however, is EPA just released a waiver earlier this year that can waive the requirement for BABA for buying construction made in America if so the capital projects have initiated project design planning prior to May 14th of 2022. So we would help and assist the agency in utilizing this waiver for any of those appropriate projects, which would likely help to reduce the overall project need for those construction costs of certain other of the capital programs that can apply for this waiver. Next slide, please. As we stated here on, or as I mentioned earlier about a master agreement, what has been recently instituted by the EPA program is this master agreement program, which in nature is a contract between EPA and the borrower to provide an upfront commitment of loan proceeds. The agency will be allowed to apply for a total project cost of a capital improvement program, such as the agency's $780 million 10-year CIP program. And utilizing that master agreement, you are then able to structure individual loan agreements once those projects are ready to proceed. And once those environmental provisions have been completed, you can start working through different loan agreements over a 3 to 5 year period that align to a maximum of that 49% project cost requirements. What this really allows an agency to do is implement loan documentation on a structure that is more streamlined. Day one, EPA will be negotiating with the agency all of its loan terms, covenants, and legal provisions in its master agreements. So any loan document that is created thereafter will be in short order or a shorter form, and also apply to and recreate what has already been agreed to day one. That will reduce the financing cost and financing burden for the agency for its next loan agreements. And it will also allow for a more streamlined approach and a simpler loan agreement that will just cover pricing information for the date and time of the new loan closing and any environmental needs that need to be completed for those certain projects. So we think the agency is a great candidate to apply with its letter of interest submission for a master agreement for its 10-year CIP. Next slide, please. What we want to identify here on these next two slides is give you a range of where the 30-year U.S. Treasury has been historically over this past five-year period since 2017. In this period of time, the U.S. Treasury has been, or 30-year U.S. Treasury has been very volatile, looking at a low of approximately 1.4% and a high of almost 3.5% back in 2018. Since this chart was created in July 29th, the U.S. Treasury market has continued to increase. As of today, a 30-year U.S. Treasury rate is approximately 3.5%. So it has increased past what we have shown here on the slide as of July 29th. But this does give you a flavor of the constant movement of where that 30-year Treasury market will go and may go as the agency looks to acquire and hopes to acquire potentially this type of funding with the EPI. Next slide, please. What we wanted to identify here is the potential savings thresholds that can be generated from an agency utilizing the terms and structure of a WIFIA loan versus a long-term debt issuance. This savings assumptions here is not a recommendation of a certain financial structure or a financial analysis. It really tries to implement and show the perspective of where rates can be on any given day when you compare funding and financing a long-term capital needs with debt issuance versus funding through the EPA's loan program. Based off of market conditions as of August 3rd, were the agency to need to fund, for example, $360 million of long-term capital needs, we structured and calculated the comparison between a 30-year long-term debt issuance and a 49% cap of a WIFIA loan that can be structured at those same rates, amortized over or repaid over a longer period of time. As you see here in our assumptions and notes, the difference in those rates would be a 3.9% for a long-term bond issuance over a 30-year period versus the rate that we would have acquired from the EPA at a 3.05%. What this shows is the benefit of the WIFIA loan's lower interest rates, low-cost funding. Even if it's subsidized at a 49% threshold, you're able to utilize that lower cost and spread it over that longer term, which under these assumptions would allow the agency to potentially save almost $29 million on a net present value basis over the term of its debt issuances. Again, this is a structure that helps to formulate the types of amortization structures that can be utilized by the EPA program. And again, what types of savings can be utilized if the agency were to be accepted to this loan program. Our recommendation is for the board to pursue and to apply to the letter of interest program funded by the Environmental Protection Agency in hopes of having it be another tool in the agency's box of options for potential capital funding needs going forward. Applying to the letter of interest program to EPA does not require the agency to fund debt service or to enter into any debt obligation. It just provides another opportunity to fund any long-term capital projects. The staff and our firm will be bringing back to the agency's board for additional approval if the agency is accepted by the EPA to pursue an application to actually acquire additional funding going forward. That concludes our presentation for this evening regarding the WIFIA loan program, and I would like to pass it off to the board president to open up for questions or comments.
Are you continuing, Rochelle? Are you ready?
Just real quick, just to add to Laura's presentation, and thank you very much, Laura. Repeating that the letter of interest to the EPA does not require the agency to have a commitment in the WIFIA program at this time. The financial considerations for the letter of interest is set about $50,000. That is for bond counsel, the municipal advisor time, and also an engineering firm to help us prepare that letter of interest. The committee did also ask us to add to the board report what the estimated cost might be if we were asked to file an application, and then what it would be for that master agreement. The application cost is projected about $205,000, and the master loan agreement at about $430,000. And so at this time, the Finance Administration Committee recommends that the Board of Directors approve completing a letter of interest form for the EPA's WIFIA program.
Thank you, Rochelle. Thank you for the presentation. We have any public comment before we go to board questions or discussion?
We do not.
Very good. We open up for board discussion on this item before we take a motion. Director Gusek.
Thank you. And I unfortunately missed this finance committee meeting, but I did have a question on the cost to prepare the application, or a comment that I had emailed before, unfortunately missing the meeting. And that's one of the reasons why I asked the engineering manager if we get quotes and bounced it off an engineering estimate, because the public burden time on this is estimated at 60 hours. And we have a template that was already provided by EPA on what to do, and the submittal cannot exceed 50 pages. Just doing the quick math on the hours provided, and I'm being generous here, I think, in assuming $300 an hour, which is high-end engineering hours, low-end legal hours, comes to 166 hours if everybody doing this work on the template that's already prepared charges $300 an hour, comes to 166 hours. I would like to know if we're getting hourly estimates on this and what these firms are billing at, because it seems high.
So I think the 60 hours is a really low number. I'm sure our engineering staff have already put in quite a few hours just trying to get our projects together. We did receive a quote from Stantec Engineering, which has performed a lot of these, the work for the letter of interest for their project management, the letter of interest development review, our existing documentation, which requires environmental work. They estimate the letter of interest at 126 hours.
Did we get competitive? I mean,
and it's the price would be $29,165. That doesn't include any bond counsel or municipal advisor time. So that's why we felt the $50,000 not to exceed was a good number.
Well, I personally would like us to, coming on the finance side, get more competitive bids and have a reality check with the public. I know when we looked at the finance changeover, original estimate was $1 million, and it came in at half of that after being pressed. And I just think to fill in a template, I mean, we're a public agency. We shouldn't be feeling like we have unlimited money and we could be a little more efficient, in my opinion. I mean, I guess as a counter proposal, I'd like to see us try to cap this at maybe 30,000, because that's, you know, closer to their hour estimate. I do government reporting burden all the time, and my projects come in under the reporting burden. So I don't know why we think it's going to be low. So that's my comment.
I'm not sure, Laura, if you can maybe describe the information that's required in the letter of interest. I know the template is there, but we were talking about adding our PAYGO projects in there too. So we're about $700 million of projects over the next 10 years. Of going through all each project and identifying if it's innovative, what benefit does it have. It will take a lot of staff time and consultant time. We definitely can get another quote, although Stantec was highly recommended as being successful in this letter of interest program with Lithia.
That's correct, Rochelle. Part of the template is describing not only the agency itself and the creditworthiness of the agency, but also a lot of the questions are pertaining to the exact and total eligible project costs. Due to the agency's large capital infrastructure needs of that 10-year CIP, there is multiple capital projects will have to be identified in this template program, such as what the project is, total costs amounted to each individual project, as well as describing those projects, such as Rochelle indicated, project criteria list that's about 10 to 11 questions and points in the LOI submission that asks for details of whether or not the project itself provides innovative opportunities. Does it remove any lead in water drinking structure? Does it provide economic or other very important structural and economic benefits, new jobs, post or pre-construction jobs? So there are very detail-oriented questions per each capital project that EPA will be looking for information purposes to review and analyze whether it's an appropriate project to pursue. And lastly, there is also additional sections that require detail of documentation pertaining to how those costs were arrived at, whether it's planning and design documents or other types of planning documents internally from staff's perspective, such as the budget document, for example.
That complete? Okay. Thank you, Murray. Director Gusay, Vice President Ozahowski.
Regarding the Build America, Buy America Act, I imagine the burden of proof is on our engineering vendors, engineering construction companies. Is that right? To provide information that their materials are made in the U.S.?
There is a certification program. So once the project is identified, the vendor would need to certify that it is American iron and steel. There's also a part of the program which may require some additional staff time of going out and actually inspecting the site to make sure that they look at the prevailing wage records for the Davis-Bacon Act. So there's all sorts of checks and balances after the projects are approved.
Understood. Does that also include construction equipment, not necessary materials?
That I'm not sure.
Okay, understood.
I'm not sure that we would be purchasing additional equipment, renting equipment maybe.
Okay. Thank you. Back to you, President Martin.
Any other comments or discussion? Director Cooper, go ahead.
Rochelle, just for my clarification, is so we put in this letter of interest in it, and it we identify all the projects that we've got in our $700 million CIP. And then they look at all of these, and do they identify then which ones this would apply to, or do they come back and say, okay, you've got a number of projects here, PFAS and climate change projects and things. And they, do we apply at that point for an amount of money? And that amount of money just kind of sits in an account until we're ready to use it and draw from it. Is that how it works?
I believe so. And Laura can expand on it, but I do believe that when we have our list of projects, we have a timeline of when we think we are going to be constructing those projects. WIFIA will go through our project list to see if it's eligible or not. Some of them, our projects may not be, and those would be eliminated. But then we would be able to go through, and I believe there's three issuances, and the last one is at the five-year period. So we would want to know, you know, on year one or year three or year five, how much we would be looking. We would need to let them know in that we would have three separate loans with WIFIA and tell them how much we would want in each one of those issues.
And so they'll provide 49%, and we can use other financing to provide the Correct. Remainder of that. It seems like this would be excellent for our PFAS construction projects. A lot of the other stuff, I'm not so sure how good it'd be, but for PFAS, where we need it, and we need it rather quickly, this would be very helpful.
Yes, that is definitely a project that's eligible.
Thank you.
Director Planbeck.
Yeah, I agree. It would be great for the PFAS. I don't, you mentioned, I'm not on the Finance Committee, as you know, so I'm coming to this new and it's a little complicated. I thought I heard you mention you would include the PAYGO projects in the list, and I'm not quite sure why we would be borrowing money for projects we determined were PAYGO. I thought we were trying to reduce our debt burden.
So if we include the PAYGO projects, because the WIFIA will loan up to 49% of the projects and the remaining 51% would have to come either from rates or from another type of loan program. So that 51% could come from our PAYGO that we're generating through rates now. So we would include all the projects in order to have a portion of them, maybe as with a lower interest rate.
So we would not be borrowing money to pay for PAYGO, but they would go towards the 51% share for the capital projects that we would borrow for okay. by taking it in aggregate.
That's right. Thanks. Yes.
Director Cooper.
And it would give you the opportunity. Go ahead.
This would be, you identify all the projects and you would identify the ones that you can start within 5 years. So the ones that are out 15 years, they're not really interested in. But say we've got $700 million worth of projects now, we can do 80 or 90 or 100 million within the next 5 years, then that would be the group of projects that they would finance. Is that what kind of what I'm hearing?
I believe so. We would tell them how much and which projects that we can do in a certain period of time, because we wouldn't want to commit to that loan for something that's 5 years out when we'd be doing it within 3 years.
And then they kind of approve you for that whole group.
Right. In the 10-year, the master 10-year agreement, we would get, it would, like Laura said, it's a very small, much smaller process than to get the loan two and loan three.
And it's cheaper than going out on the regular bond market that we've used before and doing certificates of participation. This would be a better deal. When they say that the repayment doesn't start the first 3 years or whatever it is that the first 3 years after you've got the project built? Is it kind of like a home equity line of credit where you just draw on it as you need it as you go down the road?
So,
and it changes then?
Right. After when project is completed, that's when that particular part of that loan repayment starts. So, but we wouldn't be necessarily drawing on it. We would be supplying them invoices and they would be reimbursing us.
Okay. So you're not paying on the whole amount.
Correct. We're only paying
just on
the amount
portion you've drawn on as you've gone along.
Yes.
Wow. That's
right.
Pretty interesting.
And to add on to your initial question as well, Director, you are correct. If you apply for the master agreement for a total amount of $780 million of projects, they won't allow you to continue to utilize loan agreements past that five-year mark. They want to issue to you your 49% of eligible project costs within that 3 to 5 year window. So however projects are ready to go within that 3 to 5 year window, up to the 49% capital cap of your funding needs, that will be applied to and utilized as your drawing source of funds to fund for those separate capital projects.
So that's what makes the submitting the letter of interest a little more complicated, is because you have to identify those
correct.
Early on in the process.
And they all have to be eligible. That's correct.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
I was told that the letter of interest is more important than the application. So if we get our letter of interest right, we would have a better chance of being invited to apply.
Correct. The letter of interest round is a competitive round. So you'll be competing with other agencies throughout the nation that's vying for the WIFIA program. So we think it is a very important round, because if you're not accepted, you'll have to wait approximately another year before you can submit a second LOI.
Vice President Ozahusky.
In that case, Mr. Poore, what would make our letter of intent appealing to the review board?
It was certainly a PFAS, because that's one of the projects that the EPA has identified for this round. So it's a high priority for EPA to provide funding for PFAS or other contaminants, the removal of other contaminants. But also, energy efficiency is very important to them, because they recognize, there's a lot of energy involved with moving water throughout the nation, especially California, throughout the state. So that's a very important factor for them, as well as just generally providing. We think also the recycled water project would be a very appealing project for them as well. And then, as we write these up, we try and make it such that it's a little bit of a marketing effort. You want to distinguish yourselves from other projects that are coming to them from across the nation. So it's a little bit of a wordsmithing and writing it so that it's appealing to the panel that's going to review your LOI. And honestly, we've been very successful. Nine of our 10 LOIs have been successful in proceeding to the second round of an application. Traditionally, it's very difficult not to get a loan once you've been invited to submit an application. So most borrowers are very successful. I don't know exactly what the percentage rate is, but it's very high. They tell us once you're in the application stage and your application is approved, it's very close to being a certainty that the loan will get signed at some point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Poore. Back to you, President Martin.
Director Gusek.
I just wanted to ask, don't we have a long-term capital plan? We have something to give the consultants that has this information already, right? They're not starting from scratch, is my understanding, right?
Halfway. So our traditional debt finance projects have a little bit more information than we have on our PAYGO projects. They're about equal in cost over the next 10 years. We did have to provide information when we did our last bond issue, and some of these projects are still on there. So we do have a little bit more detail, but definitely not for all the projects.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely see the value of this application. I do want to see if we can move on the finance side to get more, something similar to an engineering estimate and competitive pricing, because it seems like, and I haven't been there for a while, but it seems like, we come in and say, this is going to be $100,000. Everybody's like, okay, without figuring out where that number came from. And I know on the engineering side, that's how it's done, but I don't remember seeing it on finance, and I'd like to see it more going forward. But it is obviously a very good deal for us. And hopefully the consultants don't view this as a, not to exceed a price. Well, it's going to be not to exceed, but let me just say this. Some consultants will bill to the not to exceed limit without trying to come in under, and other consultants will try to do it efficiently and come in under. And I think we need to look more at that competitive side for stuff like this going forward.
Any other director questions or comments? I haven't heard from Director Kelly yet. Are you still on the line, Director Kelly? I'd like to hear, how strong was the recommendation from finance to move this forward?
Well, actually, Director Colley led the finance meeting.
Okay.
So he'd have a better insight on that. I was on it remotely, but Rochelle and I talked about the different concepts of the PAYGO versus our budget versus cash flow. And so financing is going to be something, to me, is going to be something that's going to be extremely important in order to keep us liquid.
Director Colley.
Yeah, I would. Finance Committee was certainly supportive. Finance Committee was obviously very interested in effectively being able to issue T-bills here at the agency. And the other piece of it I thought was particularly interesting is the ability to call the debt at any time. That's very valuable, particularly in this environment where rates have been spiking up over the last few months compared to the last 5 or 10 years. So as a personal comment I want to make is the it just troubles me to no end that we govern ourselves in such a way as we need to, in order to get, you know, some taxpayer money, we have to spend other taxpayer money to hire consultants to beg for it. It's just it's a crazy system we've created, but we didn't create it. Those much higher levels of the government created it, and we're just simply caught in their game. So I personally am very supportive of this, primarily because of the favorable rates and the ability to call the loan. I did hear something I thought was very interesting, and that is that the PAYGO is currently about equal to the anticipated debt financing. So I'm going to sort of remember that. I'm going to file that comment away, because what that says is that if you finance all of them with this, then we should need no other financing, that we should be able to do the 51% or at least all but 1% of that with our own rates. So if that was possible, I think that would be a very beneficial thing. So thank you.
And the repayment is once a year in $1 million increments. So you could prepay.
So thank you, Director Colley. I'm wondering, to address Director Gutsight's concern, if we move forward with the item as recommended in the staff report, whether her issues can be addressed going forward with the consultant team that we've put together. And I think she makes some good points, but I do think our consultants try to be as efficient as possible, and staff certainly tries to be efficient as possible. But I'm hoping we can move forward with this item with the idea that her issues can be addressed during the management of the process. Is that something we think we can do?
Of course. Yes.
Okay. So with that, I would entertain a motion for
President Martin. Director Colley has his hand up.
Oh, Director Colley, by all means.
I agree with most of what everybody's saying, but I think the one thing that we don't, or we can't afford to lose sight of is, you know, we use the word agency all the time, but, you know, we're a business and we're in the business of providing water, reasonable rates and everything else to go with it. And it's a revolving door, and we don't always have control over the projects, over government spending or requirements that we come up, that we're forced to come up with, that are going to make these things change up, you know, all the time. And so we have to be efficient, take the situations as they come and make the best decision that we think is going to work for us. And those decisions may change, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, just as we've always refinanced bonds and things like that to get better rates. So I look at everything here as being, you know, what's prudent for the business, what's prudent for the agency, and move forward from there.
All right, I would entertain a motion for approval of the staff recommendation. Director Colley.
Director Colley, I hope I'm not stepping on your toes as chair of the committee, but as you mentioned, I ran the meeting, so I'm assuming you'd prefer my making the motion, so I will move the staff recommended action.
And I was wearing sandals, so it would have hurt. But anyway, I'll second the motion.
All Very good. We have a motion and a second. Did we have any public comment, April, on this item?
We do not.
Very good. Unless there's any further board discussion, let's call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Planbeck.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Vice President Ozohofsky.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass.
Thank you, Board. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Rochelle. Let's move on to item 7.2. This is also presented by Rochelle Patterson. Tonight is approve a resolution adjusting the employer's contribution for the CalPERS medical insurance. Go ahead, Ms. Patterson.
So a brief history, since this item is a little hard to follow, and I will be using my notes. In August of 2021, staff had discussed options with the Finance Administration Committee and the board for how to approach an updated resolution for CalPERS. The resolution at that time anchored the employer's share of CalPERS medical premiums for employees, directors, and retirees to a specific plan called PERS Care. At that time, CalPERS merged two PPO plans, PERS Care and PERS Choice, into one plan called PERS Platinum. The PERS Care PPO was no longer an option to anchor the employer share to, thus requiring the agency to make a change to the existing resolution. So although there were many different ways to set the agency's contribution for the CalPERS medical plan, the board approved anchoring the agency's contribution at 90% of the Anthem traditional HMO for Region 3, which was the highest plan in Region 3, which is the Los Angeles area. And that began in January of 2022. By anchoring to 90% of the Anthem traditional HMO, the financial impact to employees who chose the Anthem traditional HMO and the PERS Platinum plans lessened, but employees still contributed anywhere between $21.36 to $243.25 per month in Region 3. The maximum agency contribution was set at $2,189 for the family plan. So last month, the agency received the new premiums for plans beginning January 2023 and began preparing our analysis. We wanted to ensure the agency's portion of the plan increases fell within our budget, and we needed to begin our preparation to notify our employees, directors, and retirees of the new rates and what their new monthly contribution would be for their medical coverage prior to open enrollment. We knew the largest employee, director, and retiree impact would be borne by those who selected the PERS Platinum PPO, since that is the plan that had the highest increase. The employee, directors, and retirees impact to Region 3 participants who selected the Anthem traditional HMO and the PERS Platinum plans would be anywhere between $94.27 to $374.74 per month, as shown in Attachment 3. So again, we looked at our options. If the agency would revert back to using 90% of the PERS PPO plan, which is the PERS Platinum PPO for Region 3, employees would still see an increase, but not as high as using the HMO plan as the anchor. The employee, director, and retiree impact to Region 3 participants who selected the Anthem traditional HMO and the PERS Platinum plans would be anywhere between $49.40 to $258.07 per month. For those employees and retirees that live outside of Region 3 or out of state, their monthly impact would be higher, from $41.79 to $315.82 for Region 2. That includes Fresno, San Diego, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Tulare. And from $306 to $825 for Region 1, which is primarily Northern California. Retirees that live out of state have the option of two plans, a Kaiser plan and the PERS Platinum PPO plan. The PPO plan more closely resembles the Region 3 plan costs. The out-of-state retiree impact would be $110.57 for a individual plan to $287.48 per month for a family plan. The Finance Administration Committee also discussed retirees that live out of state and retirees with spouses who also retired from the agency. A continuation of those discussions are scheduled for the October FMA committee meeting, but not discussed here tonight. Regardless of the plan that is picked to anchor the agency's contribution, whether it's the Anthem Traditional HMO or the PERS Platinum PPO for Region 3, we will still be under budget. The budget for medical insurance assumed an increase of approximately $416,000 for the year. The recommended action of anchoring the agency's contribution to the PERS Platinum PPO for Region 3 would be approximately $202,846, or $183,303 below budget. The financial considerations can be found in Attachment 4 of your packet. The FNA committee recommends that the Board of Directors set the agency's contribution under the PERS Medical and Hospital Care Act, so the agency's contribution will be 90% of the PERS Platinum PPO for Region 3, and approve a resolution adjusting the employer's contribution for PERS medical insurance. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Rochelle. Before we go to board discussion, I would like to take public comment. We do have one written public comment from former employee, Elizabeth Holmes Graziano. Some of us know her, remember her, appreciate what she did for the agency. Her public comment is in the board packet. I don't think I'll read the entire thing because it mostly addresses a future discussion that will happen at FNA in October regarding families that have two retirees in the family. And she especially appreciates Director Colley's suggestion at the last FNA on what they will take up at October 17th. She's generally in favor of the action that's before us tonight, but there's more to the story that FNA will consider at the next meeting. So please refer to your public comment that you received in your board packet. Do we have any other public comments?
It was a handout. So it was a handout tonight. It was at each of their spots.
That's the handout.
Yeah.
Okay. It is. Handout. So, do we have any other members of the public online that wish to comment?
We do not.
All right. Then we can have a discussion and perhaps a motion if someone would like to make. Director Cooper.
You know, back in my working career at Metropolitan, we dealt with this issue over the years many times. And it the way 1 year HMOs will go up, and then the next year HMOs don't go up very much, but the PPOs go up, and it just kind of seems to rotate. And so we were jumping around saying, okay, this time let's take the highest PPO and we'll take that rate. And then the next time it comes around, let's take the highest HMO rate. And it's like we were always looking for the highest rate. Rates are going to go up. I mean, medical goes up. And then, so we finally ended up putting in the employees' contracts that it would be 90% of the highest rate, period. Whether it was the PERS Platinum, whether it was Kaiser, whether it was Anthem Blue Cross, it was just going to be that year the highest, 90% of the highest rate. So we didn't have to do this jumping around all the time, and then the employees were a little better off in that they knew what it was going to be, that it was going to be 90% of whatever the highest rate was, so that they didn't risk running into anything extremely high on them. I personally would like to see us do that. I'd like to see us just make it 90% of the highest rate for Region 3, and then we don't have to deal with it in the future. And I think that would be fair to all of the employees. The issue of two employees retiring from the same agency really is kind of a PERS thing. I think PERS is the one that is supposed to handle those kinds of issues. But I'd like to make we don't call it a substitute motion anymore, is I'd like to make an amendment that we just make it 90% of the highest rate.
I believe this is the first motion, is it not? So there's nothing to amend. You just move what you want to make a motion for.
But then I make the motion that we just make it 90% of the highest rate of the insurance is offered.
Do we have a
second? I'll second that.
Second by Director Busse.
Can I just clarify in Region 3?
In Region 3.
Region
any other really... discussion?
You and April are kind of alike.
Vice President Ozahowski.
In terms of recruitment and employee retention, it's important for our agency to have to offer good medical insurance to the employees and his or her family. So absolutely in agreement with Director Cooper's motion.
Any other comments on the motion? Director Armitage.
I'll just say I agree. I think we started to have that conversation in FNA, but we got so sidetracked with all the details, everything else, that we never circled back to that. So I'm glad you brought that up, and I agree as well. Thank you.
All right. Director Ford.
Yes, I would agree with the motion as well, too. But I did have a question of staff. Is my understanding that retirees are not eligible for in lieu substitute of the premium?
Right. That's correct. And that's one thing that we are checking with legal counsel and with CalPERS to see if we're not quite sure if an employee that is a spouse that was also a retiree can opt out and then potentially receive in lieu, which would cover the additional 10% or whatever is over the 90% of the highest plan because the out-of-state rates are higher. That we can look at, but we want to make sure that an employee can opt back in if they lost coverage for any particular reason. So we are looking at different scenarios, and we will bring that back in October.
Okay, thank you.
Director Cooper.
Since you pay 90% of whatever the highest plan is for a family, and say it's $1,800, for an individual, it's about $700, somewhere in that range. Can't those employees sign up individually as individuals on their, and then it's fully paid because there's no deductible then, or there's no 90% because the 90% is on the family.
It's 90% of the plan you're in. So it's not approving $1,800 cap for everybody. It would be 90% of the plan for your individual plan. So if it's a family plan or individual plus one or family, it's still 90% of that rate.
Okay, that's the way you're, and that's fine. Okay.
All right, we have a motion and a director colleague, go ahead.
Yeah, first, I would, that particular structure we just mentioned is not one I would support. And I also have not supported for quite a few years what I view as kind of runaway costs here. We could provide a lower number and employees could still get very good care without paying any part of the premium. So I believe, and I've said this for now for most of a decade, probably or more, that this is, we should not be just simply going with the highest cost continuously. But I'm obviously a minority and I'm not going to waste a lot of the board's time with a minority voice.
All right, we have a motion and a second on the floor. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Planbeck.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Colley.
No.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass. As stated by Director Cooper, 90% of the highest rate of the insurance offered in Region 3.
Very good. Thank you, Board. Thank you, staff, for the presentation and the information. Move on to item 7.3. Presenter tonight is our friend Rick Verguz, and it's to approve appointments of a director and alternate director to the SCVGSA Board of Directors for the remainder of the 2021-2023 term. Mr. Verguz, would you like to make the presentation, after which the board will take up the question?
Sure. Thank you, President Martin. Good evening, directors. As you said, Director Martin, this item tonight reflects that with the retirement of Director Atkins and the passing away of Director Gladbach, both of whom served on the GSA board as a director and alternate, respectively, that there are now two vacancies on the GSA board. This is an action to request your board approve a new director and alternate to the GSA board, and that it provides a written statement to that effect by October 3rd, 2022. Yeah. That concludes my verbal presentation, President Martin.
Thank you, Rick. With that, I think we all understand the question at hand. Do we have a nomination for the new director for the GSA board? Yes. Do we have any public comment, April, before we proceed?
We do not.
Very good. So
I'll say again. President Martin, you might want to call for them separately for the regular seat and for the alternate.
This is for the regular seat. This is for the regular GSA board seat. Do we have a motion for an appointment?
I would like to nominate Director Orzechowski for the regular seat.
We have a nomination for Director Orzechowski, Vice President Orzechowski.
I would like to nominate Director Ford for the seat.
Okay, so we have a nomination for Director Ford and nomination for Vice President Orzechowski. Director Armitage.
Thank you. I'm wondering if it seems to me would be logical to perhaps offer, if there's interest, to either of the current alternate directors, Director Kelly or Director Plumbeck, the opportunity to serve as the director, since they have been serving as the alternate and they've been listening in and following along in recent history. So it would make sense to me to see if they would be interested in being nominated and perhaps giving them consideration.
Well, I would just say directors were free to nominate whomever they want. So,
okay, well, then I nominate both directors Plumbeck and Director Kelly.
All right, so we now have four nominations. Mr. Bond, do we take those in the order that they were nominated and to see if we can get the necessary votes?
Yeah, there's no strict procedure Director for Cooper. That, but that certainly works.
Okay, Director Cooper, you have your hand up.
I'd like to just ask Vice President Orzechowski, since you were nominated, but then you turned around and nominated Mr. Ford, were you withdrawing your nomination for this?
Thank you, Director Cooper. Yes, I withdraw my nomination.
Thank you.
Very good. So,
I would draw me being nominated.
Very good. So the first, as I understand now, the first nomination is for Director Ford. Can we take that a vote on that, Mr. Bunn? All right. So we do have a motion and a second nominating Director Ford. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
We actually have a nomination, but not a motion and a second for Director Ford. So if I got that, then I could move forward.
I'll second Director Ford.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Director Colley.
Hoping a discussion is appropriate at this point.
Yes.
All right. My preference, and with no ill will intended, would be, since this is going to be something that goes on, that the nomination or the appointment would presumably go on beyond December. My preference would be to have someone who is at least possibly going to be on this board beyond December. So I think it would be more appropriate for us to elect someone who is, whose service is at least likely to continue or possibly could continue. Again, that doesn't intend, I don't intend to disparage anybody that didn't file for re-election or whatever. That's not my point.
Okay, let me respond to that a little bit, at least on the legal side. Mr. Bunn, there's no prohibition of Director Ford continuing on as SCVGSA board member beyond the end of his appointed term at the end of this year. Is that correct?
So just to make sure, I didn't suggest in any way, shape, or form that there was a legal question there. What I suggested was my preference.
And I never suggested that you did.
I think asking for legal opinion implied something that I didn't say.
Okay. I just wanted for more information.
You're correct, President Martin.
Very good. Thank you. I just wanted that to be out there. So we do have a motion and a second. Please call the roll, April.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Colley.
No.
Director Plambeck.
No.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Abstain.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
No.
Vice President Orzechowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
This item did not pass.
All right, then we move to the next nominee, which I think you nominated two people, Kelly and Director Plambeck. Which would you like to nominate first?
Director Plambeck first.
Is that a motion for Director Plambeck?
Yes.
We have a second.
I will second it.
All right, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Colley.
No. Oh, sorry, yeah.
This is
not common. So my vote is to support the nomination. So yes.
Director Ford.
No.
Director Kelly.
Abstain.
Director Cooper.
No.
Director Gutzeit.
No.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Vice President Orzechowski.
No.
President Martin.
No.
This item did not pass.
All right, the last nominated person is also not running for re-election, so will not be back in 2023. Director Colley, does that, it's just so you know. Okay. So do we have a motion for Director Kelly?
I'll make the motion.
Do we have a second? Do we have a second? We have no second for this nomination. So that fails. Is that correct, Mr. Bunn?
Yes.
Mr. President?
Correct? Yes.
Sorry.
Director Cooper.
I would like to nominate Director Orzechowski.
We have a second for that nomination.
Second.
We have a second. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Director Goodside.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Ozahofsky, or Vice President Ozahofsky.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass. For Director Ozahofsky as the, the primary director.
Thank you. Congratulations, Vice President Ozahofsky. We now can take nominations for the alternate.
I'd like to nominate Kathy Armitage.
Excuse me?
Kathy Armitage. Director Armitage.
Okay, so we have a nomination for Director Armitage. We have any other nominations? Director Cooper.
Director Ford, please.
Okay. Any other nominations? All right. Do we have a motion for Director Armitage?
I'll move that Director Armitage fill the alternate seat.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Second, Director Kelly.
Very good. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
Yes.
Director Ford.
No.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
No.
Director Goodside.
No.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahofsky.
No.
President Martin.
No.
This item did not pass.
All right. So we now have do we have a motion for Director Ford as the alternate?
I will second Director Ford.
Who led the motion? Who made the motion?
Cooper.
Okay. Director Cooper made the motion. Director Goodside made the second. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Kelly.
I'm going to abstain because I don't care for the politics. So I abstain. Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
No.
Director Armitage.
No.
Director Goodside.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahofsky.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
This item did not pass. Did I miss somebody? Oh, Plambeck. Director Plambeck.
No.
This item did not pass.
Okay. Well, we don't have an alternate yet, folks. So, excuse me. Next meeting. All right, we will.
Yeah, just to clarify, President Martin, the fan is sort of throwing me off here. We do have the two existing alternates still, and they are, the way we structured this, the three alternates back up the four directors. So we just have a little short squad here. If more than two directors can't make it, then we're short. But with two alternates, assuming they're available, we would still be able to cover. I'll just note also that at least the write-up says that the JPA allows the board of directors to reappoint or change its appointed directors at any time. So I'm not sure that we're locked into a term, as may have been stated or implied earlier. If the board wished to fill a seat, the board after January could revisit that seat in light of the results of the election. So just food for future thought.
Thank you. Good point, Mr. Stone.
And the final thought I'd add is if we, I don't think it's as critical with the alternate positions,
But if we had had an impasse, I was going to offer to stand in that role for the remainder of the year until we could perhaps reach a consensus. So thanks.
Director Colley.
Based on the new information, I would nominate for the alternate position, Director Ford.
All right. And
well, it's new information that we did not have 2 minutes ago. So I would, since I voted no, I thought maybe that council had suggested that I could renew the motion.
Mr. Bunn?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mr. Bunn, respond. Can you respond your, can you say your statement again, Mr. Bunn?
I believe Director Colley is correct. He voted no, and now he wants to revisit that vote. And so he's allowed to make a motion. Technical parliamentary procedure is he's allowed to make a motion for reconsideration. And then you vote on that, and then you have nominations. I don't think that's necessary in this case.
Reconsideration, meaning we take a vote on the entire board again?
No, reconsideration of the nomination of Mr. Ford.
Okay.
And I think we can, if this passes, I think you can take that as an election of Director Ford. So you only have, in my judgment, you only have to have one vote.
So do we have to vote on the reconsideration or?
Yes.
Okay. So.
So just to be clear, what I'm trying to do is make a motion that Director Ford be the alternate.
I'm sorry. I was confusing that by talking about the technical requirements of Roberts. I believe you're in order to make that motion.
Okay. And so if that gets a second, we can vote on my motion.
Okay. Do we have a second?
I'll second that, President Martin.
Second by Vice President Ozahowski. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
No.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
No.
Vice President Ozahowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
This item does pass. Congratulations, Director Ford. You are the alternate.
Thank you, and congratulations, Director Ford. All right. I believe we're ready to move on to item 7, action items. No, I'm sorry. We are finished with that item. I should know better because... Rebecca has been waiting patiently to make this presentation. So we're on item 8, annual safety program update for fiscal year 21-22. Environmental health and safety supervisor, Rebecca Lustig, will make the presentation. And by the way, once again, welcome to the agency.
Thank you. Just talk louder? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to say good afternoon, board members, but it's good evening, board members. My name is Rebecca Lustig. I'm the Environmental Health and Safety Supervisor for the agency. Just started on July 5th. So tonight I'll be presenting the annual safety program update for the agency, covering the previous fiscal year time period, July 1st, 2021 to June 30th, 2022. I would just like to preface this by saying that because I'm new, this presentation covers a time period of which I was not with the agency. So I prepared it discussing with my team incidents, trainings, inspections, and other safety-related items with my safety team. However, you may have some specific questions of which I do not have firsthand knowledge. And if that is the case, then I will do my best to follow up with any information to answer those questions at a later date. Next slide. Okay, so this is kind of a wordy slide, but this is a list of several activities and projects that the safety department conducted over the past fiscal year. So some routine stuff, we have a monthly worksite and facility inspections, meeting with the safety committee, supervisors monthly, and also weekly and bi-monthly tailgates and weekly COVID-19 meetings. So these activities give the safety department opportunities to observe and discuss various safety-related items in the agency across different departments and different sites. Some additional activities conducted that are still ongoing and active to increase staff safety and preparedness include a noise assessment that was recently completed and which will inform any changes to the agency's hearing conservation program. We have an ongoing heat illness awareness prevention program, which we're going to see a little more in a couple of slides. We got new gas detection meters for Earl Schmidt filtration plant and did firmware updates at all locations. So gas meters were replaced because they were a little out of date and old and not functioning, and the firmware updates were part of a routine cyber maintenance. The safety department secured a grant to purchase emergency communication radios, and we're happy to say that the radios have been received, and we are currently working with operations and fleet services to get them installed in vehicles. Backup cameras and alarms were installed on agency vehicles and received a lot of positive feedback from staff on those. And we're finalizing the revalidation process for the ammonia hydroxide risk management program. And another program that is ongoing is to look at some data management tools and software for the safety department. So examples would be doing our monthly inspections electronically, and that doesn't mean that it's remote. We still have staff going doing the site inspections in person, but the reports, comments, notes, and concerns are being entered and tracked electronically. So hopefully that will help with providing data on common concerns and repeated issues, and to help us with the ability to prevent incidents in the future. We've also been using a program called CLEAR for project management and regulatory compliance and permit tracking. And we partnered with the agency IT to use Maplet as a way to identify things like hot work permits and confined space information. Next slide, please. Just to, because pictures are worth a thousand words, here's some pictures of two of the projects that I just mentioned. So we can see one is a backup camera. That's the view that agency staff gets when they're backing up. So it provides them a clear view as they back up to prevent them hitting some stationary objects. And we see one of the radios that have been installed in an agency vehicle for emergency preparedness. Next slide, please. So this slide contains some emergency preparedness activities and projects that the safety department staff has conducted or was a part of coordinating. So just some highlights in May of this just a few months ago, we brought the LA County Fire Station 111 staff on site to do a drill and target hazard walkthrough. This is going to be done in the future, at least every 3 years or possibly more frequency. And the feedback we got from the fire department was that it was very well received. And we had fire staff who had never been to any of our facilities before and enjoyed their visit. We also have ongoing coordination with and training with agency staff in emergency action plan trainings, site safety monitors, and tracking of emergency supplies. Safety staff also secured a grant to purchase the emergency communication radios, as I mentioned earlier. Another emergency action that we've been working on is a mass notification system called Alert Media, and recently have went live with a desktop takeover. So whenever there's an alert media message, it will take over someone's desktop so they don't miss that notification, and incorporated the single sign-on. So you can sign on to the alert media with your agency passwords. FEMA grants, so COVID-19 disaster funding. We secured some FEMA grants to offset costs for PPE, like masks and disinfection supplies for work sites. And safety department staff has been involved in meetings and planning activities for our local disaster preparedness activities and plannings, including collaboration with the City of Santa Clarita, the Local Emergency Planning Committee Region 1, Cal Warren Region 1, and the LA County Disaster Management Area B. Next slide, please. So it comes as no surprise to any of you that Santa Clarita Valley experiences some very high temperatures from time to time. And when that does occur, agency staff still goes out and does their job and work in these very high temperatures. So in order to address and raise awareness of heat illness, the safety department has conducted tailgates, assigned online training courses, and we've been sending out heat illness reminder emails on the high heat days with information and precautions to take. So staying hydrated, taking breaks, and we also recently pushed out a heat index app on agency mobile devices. So staff can check hourly heat index in the area and look up symptoms of heat illness and taking precautions. And by the way, this is a free app that you can download. Anybody can. So I would also recommend if you would like to download it onto your personal devices, it is a good tool to have. Next slide, please. The safety department does lead trainings and safety related trainings to agency employees. Some of these are some fit testing, doing first aid CPR trainings, which partner with some online trainings, but also agency staff is notified of the training completions online and then does skilled sessions as needed. We're planning on returning to in-person trainings for those as well. Fire extinguisher trainings. This past year, the staff did a chlorine emergency shutdown test at Rio Vista in January. So this was a drill with operations to see if all the systems worked upon depressing the chlorine shutoff switch. And then staff involved discussed how the system worked, what to check for, and how to reactivate the system. New hires receive a safety orientation we've been working on modifying. So staff will meet all of the safety team. We'll introduce the safety page on the agency's Aquifer SharePoint site, where people can find the safety manual, the injury and illness prevention program, and staff will also do an on-site review of evacuation procedures and life safety equipment. As mentioned earlier, we also have an emergency action plan developed for each training site, and we have safety tailgate meetings. And so up on the slide, we see a variety of different topics that are discussed during tailgate trainings. Next slide, please. So in addition to staff that's conducted by safety department staff, we also coordinate trainings with outside providers. So many of these trainings are annual refreshers that are required, such as HAZWOPR training or confined space training, and has also assigned online trainings via Vector Solutions. Next slide, please. Here we see a bar graph of the number of safety trainings conducted by each quarter over this past year, as well as the number of persons who took trainings each year. And of course, people will take multiple trainings each year. So that's why we have some pretty high numbers. Next slide, please. The safety department participated in regulatory compliance related activities. So this past year, our annual SIRS reporting was completed for all relevant sites and was verified by the LA Fire CUPA inspector and when they conduct their on-site inspections. New EPA ID numbers were issued for all hazardous waste generating sites. So we realized that several of the hazardous waste manifests, like for the waste oil and things like that, were using legacy EPA ID numbers. And so in May, the safety department requested new numbers from the Department of Toxic Substance Control. And the benefit of this is that now all of the EPA ID numbers have the same federal employee ID number and can be verified on one account through the electronic verification questionnaire process. LA County CUPA did inspections for the CalARP, HazWaste, HazMat inspections programs for the agency, and our underground storage tank at Rio Vista was certified by LA Public Works. And Cal OSHA did inspections of pressure vessels or air compressor tanks on site, either by Cal OSHA or contracted to Hartford Steam and Boiler. Next slide, please. So here's a bar graph depicting the recordable and reportable incidents over the past fiscal year. So an OSHA recordable injury is an injury that results in medical treatment that requires more than simple first aid, and this is shown in red. And an OSHA reportable injury is one that results in hospitalization, and it would be shown in blue, but as you can see, we did not have any of those incidents this past year. Next slide, please. This line graph shows agency recordable incident rates compared to industry standards over the past 5 years, and it always lags behind. So our 2021-2022 incidents are being compared to Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers from 2020. So the agency rate is somewhat steady, but we can see here that the industry rate dropped and our rate went up slightly. Next slide, please. Safety metrics are leading indicators. So safety department's time has been spent in conducting trainings and meetings, inspections that are listed here. We're relatively consistent with these numbers, although I did want to note that we did have a drop in the number of meetings because the COVID-19 meetings used to occur on Mondays and Thursdays, and then were reduced to one meeting per week as things started to improve. Next slide, please. Safety metrics lagging indicators. So the source related to standard measures is here in the right column. It comes from Cal OSHA or from JPIA. So the agency's overall incident rate for this past year was 4.2. And if you recall from the line graph, that is unfortunately above the industry rate of 3.3, which is based on the 2020 numbers. I did want to note the historic incident rate is usually 5.5 to 6.0 range. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics had mentioned on their website that the year 2020 saw a drop in incident rates in industries overall, with the exception of the healthcare industry for obvious reasons. But with that said, my hope is to address the underlying causes of the reportable incidents with an emphasis on training and providing appropriate PPE and tools and a general focus on enhancing and maintaining our best-in-class safety culture. Next slide, please. And specific safety metrics for vehicles. There were a total of 13 incidents which involved agency vehicles, mostly in the second and the fourth quarter. The ones resulting in injury, I looked those up and it seemed as though they were related to outside influences, such as an agency vehicle being hit by a member of the public. The more minor incidents, things like some scrapes or backing, slowly backing into objects, can be attributed to some unsafe acts, which we will hopefully address with our backup cameras that have just recently been installed. And staff is aware of this. And so with the vehicle incidents, additional safety classes were assigned to the staff involved, and supervisors and safety staff discussed situational awareness, defensive driving, and has had discussions with staff individually and in tailgates about awareness and attention to performing work, including the driving task as at a safe pace and keeping their minds on the job at hand. Next slide, please. And so this concludes the annual safety presentation for this past fiscal year, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Rebecca, for the presentation. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment?
We do not.
Very good. Any comments, discussion from the board? Director Armitage.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Lustig. It's exciting to meet you in person finally. And thank you for the work that you're already jumping into and enthusiastically doing. So appreciate that. One comment, one question. I was really glad to see the emphasis on heat illness prevention, given the temperatures we're all experiencing right now. And then I have a question about the hearing conservation program, because that's the first time I'm noticing that. Can you just give us a little bit of information on that?
So the hearing conservation program, currently the noise assessment that was conducted was at different work sites to see the decibel levels that employees are exposed to. And right now we're following up with taking noise measurements and noise ratings of certain equipment. So part of what that information is going to feed into with the hearing conservation program is to determine the types of hearing PPE that is going to be needed for particular job sites. So for example, we have those foam disposable earplugs at different sites, but if this is a situation where there is a higher volume or if there is a vibration component in the equipment, then those types of PPE isn't going to necessarily address all of those types of concerns, particularly not for a long-term exposure. So those are some of the things that we're working on for a hearing conservation program.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. A couple quick questions. I was excited to learn that we actually had an environmental audit from Mr. Stone. Do you know the status of that? Were the findings closed out, or are we still working on some of the findings from that?
Are you asking about the CalArb?
No, I believe we hired an independent environmental audit.
Yeah, it's a, there was a, well, let me mutually explain to both of you the situation.
Okay. Yes.
So Rebecca, Director Gutzeit was previous on the board for many years and then was recently appointed. So there was a gap between her suggestion that we get an outside firm who did work with Mark and our staff to conduct an audit. And to answer the question, yes, there was a whole punch list of items that were identified. I don't know whether all of them were closed out or any of them are still pending. And my guess is Rebecca probably wouldn't have the detailed answer to that question.
Okay, but it's there for reference. Yeah.
But I know that there were quite a few that we did address, and we can conjure that up and see where that stands. I believe I think just about everything that could be addressed was addressed, but I don't want to categorically say every single thing without checking on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I guess my favorite thing is chlorine and CalArb and all that. Do you happen to know, or maybe Mr. Snow knows, are we in Homeland Security, out of Homeland Security regulations on the chlorine? Anybody know that? Might have come up on the audit, but we should take a look, because usually once you're in CalArb, you have to be in Homeland Security. So maybe the auditors got that. Because then there's a whole bunch of other people that come in and inspect you.
So I know for the CalArp program, we do have our COOPA inspector for CalArp that I have been in contact with, but I will check on the Homeland Security.
Because the emergency response, that LERC and LEP group, emergency response people, they also run with the Homeland Security crowd, and they might know.
To show you how dedicated our staff are, lurking Mike Alvord has texted that everything in the Tetra Tech audit has been closed out.
Oh, good. Lurking Mike Alvord. That's terrific. And Tetra Tech is a good firm. So that was.
Yeah, it was a good process.
So that answers
Vice President.
Your
question. Oh, go ahead, Vice President
Zlosky. Ms. Lusting, welcome to the board meetings. You talked about the hard work permits and the digital logs, Maplet and Fulcrum. Have there been any resistance to using these digital permits and digital logs? Have everyone accepted them? And are there any issues, like software issues?
So as far as people accepting it, right now these are kind of internal management systems that we've been looking at. So we have been... It's the safety team that's been using these tools, and they were initiated by the safety department, so they were fully dedicated to them. We just recently went live with putting the hot work permits on Maplet, and the staff that uses Maplet is already accustomed to it and already knows how to use it. And we haven't gone live with the confined space. So not to my knowledge has anybody, as far as like field staff using those, come back with any resistance to it.
Okay, and no software issues with both, with Fulcrum and Maplet, right?
I wouldn't call them software issues, but there's always something you can work through, especially when you're in a new program, to figure out how it can best work for you.
Okay, thank you.
No failures, though. That I know for sure.
That's good. Thank you, Pickhorn.
So thank you very much for the update on the backup cameras. It's been a little while in coming, and I'm a huge fan of them. I think of the times that I've gotten in a car without one. I look over at the radio and start backing up, realizing after a couple of feet that that's not going to help me. So I think it's actually gotten to the point where there's a lot of folks that expect to see it there. And I think we're without it, we're actually in a little extra danger, because there are folks like me that forget that it may not be there. Question, the radio, are we connected to a repeater, or are they just point to point? Do you know?
That I do not know. Okay. But I can follow up on that.
If you could, maybe Mike Alvord, who, thanks Mike for being there and spending your evening with us.
The repeater?
Repeater is the answer.
Wow. Thank you. I thought it probably would be. What's that Mike Alvord that said that? Honestly. Wow. I should not say get a life. So thank you, Mike.
Any other questions for Mike?
Well, yeah. I'm sorry. Your heat injury is obviously huge, particularly in this particular heat wave. Question, have we considered having some staff look at some of the things the military, because the military has a lot of experience with heat injuries, their regulations, and they do things that we probably don't do, a wet bulb temperature, which is taken at a central location and broadcast out to the troops. There are other things I think that we might consider. And so I would like staff, if possible, to maybe leaf through some of the Army regulations as they apply to prevention of heat injuries. I think they have a lot of experience that is valuable. And then finally, the vehicle sorts of things. I'm not going to ask questions specifically on this, but in the future, if you could have that a little bit broken down to at fault and maybe citations issued, because being hit broadside when you're going through a green light is not something our staff could probably prevent. And so those statistics we probably ought to sort of impliedly forgive or actually forgive. So I'd like to just get a little bit better breakdown on that in the future, if that's possible.
Okay. Thank you. I did do a breakdown of it. I did not put it in the slides though. So out of the 13 incidents, I would say four of them were things that were outside influence, that were outside of the staff person's control, which would include being hit by somebody else or experiencing a medical emergency for which they had no control. The other incidents were, as I mentioned before, they're kind of the minor ones where it was backing into a light pole, scraping against a gate, and those were attention things. And a lot of those were immediately upon happening and was written in the incident report. As soon as it happened, I knew exactly what I did wrong and I should have gone slower and I should have looked, but I was thinking about the next job, the next thing to do. So that is the one thing I've noticed, that the people, the staff is very hardworking and they're very dedicated and they want to be there for their coworkers and their team and get work done. And just sort of working on that safety culture of, yes, you can do things and get your work done, but also do it safely, do it carefully, ask for help when you need it, ask for the proper tools when you need it, and always be present in the moment and the task at hand.
Yeah. One other comment, and I've made this comment before, driving around town, I oftentimes see our staff in our vehicles doing their job, driving to some other place. And in my 20 years on the board, I honestly have never seen a single one of our vehicles, and my, these are anecdotal evidence, but I've never seen a single one speeding or failing to signal or cutting someone off or just being rude in traffic or disobeying the traffic laws at all. So, 100% for my sampling is pretty good. So I appreciate it. Thank you. Any other questions or discussion for Rebecca? Seeing none, thank you again. Thank you for your focus on safety. It's very much appreciated, and keep up the good work. Thank you. With that, we can move on to item 9, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, and Programs. Mr. Stone.
Very good. I'll get right to it in light of the hour. On August 23rd, 24th, and 25th, I attended the Urban Water Institute Conference in San Diego. I will direct you to President Martin's AB1234 report, which was far better than my notes, but I will hit a couple of highlights from my own experience of the conference. There were a lot of good sessions. I was part of a group that developed a PFAS panel, which included state, federal, and local perspectives. The local agency member some of you may know quite well was Valerie Pryor, who was formerly with Castaic Lake Agency and is now general manager at Zone 7 Water. So it was nice to hear her and nice to listen to somebody else wrestling with PFAS at the local level. One of the more interesting insights in that panel came from Darren Polhamis from Cal EPA DDW in Sacramento. He's up at the high level there. There are currently 40 PFAS chemicals for which EPA has the analytical methods perfected to test for. There are another 1,200 which can be picked up on what's called non-target analysis. And I try to do a reading on what that is, but I will spare you the long definition. Essentially, it's you can see that the components are there, but you're not doing an exact identification by comparison, which is what typically is done in that kind of analysis for specific chemicals. And then there are another, depending on the data source, there are somewhere between 4,700 and 10,000 chemicals known or listed by the EPA or by an equivalent body in Europe. And his point was, this may call for a different approach from the regulatory standpoint. This isn't something that he put out as saying, this is what we're going to do. But I think he was venturing the thought that in terms of setting drinking water standards, if we're doing it one chemical at a time at some point, you know, we're going to have an awful lot of chemicals we're testing for. And I don't know that we'll have any more water to drink if we're testing at all, one test tube at a time. But he had an interesting idea, and it's a concept that has been used in some other complex drinking water regulation situations. And that was an index approach where you would develop an analytical method that would give you an index of the total amount of carbon and fluorine containing substances in the sample. And then tie that back to whether it has good predictive value for some of the currently known and regulated contaminants. And he had some examples of that. This is actually where we ended up on disinfection byproducts. At one point, there was going to be, I think, 5 or 6 different haloacetic acid compounds regulated. And they ultimately came up with total trihalomethanes as kind of a proxy for that, rather than having to measure each one individually. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting kind of development in the thought process. And as EPA begins working on a drinking water standard, and DDW will certainly be not far behind in the next few years, I think what that would mean is if you had something above a certain threshold, that you would just be required to put in a standard of treatment, and that would be deemed as meeting the requirement, because it would be removing a percentage of those compounds. Yeah. Director Cooper, it looks like he has an immediate question.
Well, General Manager Stone, the process that we're using to remove the current contaminants, does that remove all of that 4,700 group, or
we can only tell,
we don't know.
We have kind of a proxy number that he used in his example. I think it's still a little early days on that, but I think the idea would be to look at the efficacy of different types of treatment media to see how well they do. And we're going to get there at some point. If we get to a point where there's enough health effects data tied to these 40 compounds, we would essentially be treating for the one that's the first to break through, you know, the treatment media. So I think that's, you know, we'll either evolve in that direction through that path, or perhaps through some kind of total index kind of a standard. So I just wanted to share that insight. There were a number of other panels that were really interesting, a really good one on climate, drought, forest, and watershed interrelationships, which covered a lot of ground. It looked at tree ring history and calibration of data. It, for the first time I've seen anywhere, teased out or attempted to tease out the difference between long-term mega drought historic variation, of which there have been about every 400 to 500 years, there has been a mega drought, which is fairly epic, similar to what we're experiencing now. But then also trying to tease out what's happening in the departure in data in the more or less climate change or those kinds of effects. And their preliminary findings are about 40% of the moisture depletion and departure from the norm in this current long drought in the West is probably attributable to that, but some of it's attributable to the variation that's occurred. So it's an interesting perspective on that, and a lot of discussion about just sort of the mechanisms that are at work with soil depletion and how forests respond to that, and also even some interesting discussion about what happens after burns. And at least for a period of time, watershed yield actually changes upward. Of course, it may come with a lot of mud, but anyway, it's a very interesting panel. There was a panel on Colorado River conditions, which of course are, you know, front and center right now in the West and in California, with perspectives from members from each of the lower basin states, various bodies that are at the table trying to hash out where they go with the next round of shortage sharing. And it's not an easy process. And I think that was on display in the panel, but sometimes that's good to see. So, you know, it's not all roses. There are some really hard discussions going on about that. The other panel that I found interesting, I only caught part of it. Unfortunately, I got into a really, really interesting discussion outside the room with someone. But for the portion I caught, it was very interesting, which was a panel on workplace changes post-COVID. And I think we all can relate to that experience, probably many of you in your day jobs as well. So I found that quite interesting and found that our experiences aren't particularly out of line with what the panelists were talking about, and carried away a couple of good insights to think about and talk to with our staff. So I think the other fun thing was I had a chance to play music for the attendees at the conference. So there's a light moment for your to top off your evening. I think I was out there for about just under 2 hours playing songs and getting the rust off after not performing live in front of people, at least three-dimensional people, for over 3 years. So it was a good test to see if I could do it. Last week, I had a chance to attend an evening listening session with our staff, a group of our design and environmental consultants, interested members of the public, and we had a couple of board members who also came out, which I think was appreciated, to discuss the S-Wells project, which is a proposed project that would be built in the Bridgeport area. It was really good to see the level of interest from the community, and this was the night of the horrible fire-induced traffic jam. So I know people probably had a harder time getting there, but we did have a pretty good turnout and a lot of good questions and answers in that discussion. And this is just the first meeting to kind of get things up on the wall, get things on our radar from a design and aesthetic standpoint. But it was good to have that chance, and I'm sure we will be addressing as much of what we heard as we can and having another meeting with the public before finalizing our environmental report for that project, which is probably going to be a mitigated negative deck, but there's a lot of things that we can address that are design considerations, I think. I just want to take that chance too to acknowledge our PFAS strike team members from all departments. We are closing in on finishing our second treatment facility at Valley Center. We are really close to having the permit issued for that. And I look forward to, you know, the chance to acknowledge that accomplishment. And then, as you know, by approving the award of the contract for the Hanbi Santa Clara Wells treatment facility, that contractor is now, you know, getting ready to mobilize. And we should hopefully be starting work out there relatively soon. The group works diligently, and we have bi-weekly meetings to go through progress on all projects. They're all kind of moving at their pace through the preliminary siting and design and then design phase. And I just appreciate the dedication of that group, and I want to call that out and acknowledge that publicly tonight. It's a lot of work, and I have never seen a meeting more efficiently run. It's just, if you get on, you know, 2 minutes late, Mike's halfway through the first section of the agenda. So, and then earlier tonight, the board approved on the consent calendar our June quarterly financial report. And this item is included in the Finance and Administration board packet, as well as tonight's board packet. And sometimes I know the volume of financial material can be daunting in these reports. But I think that came up in some comments recently about whether people could find our financial reporting. And I wanted to make sure I emphasize that. And also something that we would like to bring forward in future quarterly reports is to actually have a report from Rochelle Patterson to the board. So rather than approve that report on consent, we would propose to include it as an informational item that could have a short presentation with some key highlights. And they don't have to be the same highlights, nor does it have to be an exhaustive, you know, bumper to bumper tour. But I think that we would like to increase the visibility of that function. And now that we've got our systems in good order, I think with implementing the Oracle project, I know that Rochelle has a lot that she can share on that. She gave me a list of all the content in the, both the monthly and the quarterly financial report, but I think I'm going to not read it all to you tonight because you had a long night. And we look forward to that. It would probably be the, I think it's the November, just count 3 months from now. The November board meeting will do the report, which would be for the quarter ended September. And as we go through that, we can fine tune, you know, what you'd like in the written versus the verbal presentation. And then finally, really finally, and poor Keith, as you know, we are all experiencing heat wave and chronic power shortages currently in the state. Have a few opinions about how we got here, but I'll leave those off the table tonight. However, the independent system operator has, as well as the governor, have really been working to try to get businesses and public agencies, and particularly the water sector, to do what they can in demand management to get us through these peak events. And what I'd like to do is invite Keith Abercrombie, not Mike, since Mike's already done a few things, to share an operations moment to let you know what SCB Water has done in response to the Flex Alert and calls for assistance. So,
thank you. Members of the board, thank you. As Matt said, and as you've heard in previous presentations this evening, heat, 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 that's all we've been about lately. And that obviously puts a strain on the electric grid as well as water systems and people themselves. The sort of pinch point for the last few weeks was yesterday, today, tomorrow, and maybe the next day, but primarily today. And so the states was forecasting today to reach a new all-time maximum demand of just over 51,000 megawatts. It looks like, from I was checking my phone earlier, it looks like some calls have been heeded by citizens and utilities alike throughout the state. And it looks like the demands are sort of slimming off. So maybe they won't quite hit that peak today. But needless to say, a rash of communications have been going out for the past week. Again, primarily focused yesterday and today. Those came to us from our local account reps, Edison, that are constantly in touch with us. We get more phone calls from them than you would like to know about all sorts of issues all the time. But there have been a serious uptick recently with them asking, you know, to reduce load during the peak demand periods, which is typically 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. or so. But Aqua, the state water contractors, they got involved and started reaching out to member agencies to asking to help shed load. As Matt said, the governor's office has gotten involved and implemented things to encourage people to put generators online, for instance, because, as you know, a generator is used in an emergency, but a power shortage typically is an emergency. And if you run your generator, you use up your hours of time. So the governor waived some of those restrictions and they asked utilities and citizens alike to reduce loads. We already, as an agency, participate in a number of demand response programs, and these are programs through typically third-party vendors that work with Edison, but some of them are directly with Edison. These programs apply to various facilities based on sizes, horsepower, et cetera, and they ask us to reduce load throughout the year when they have critical demand periods, et cetera. So those programs are already in place. But on top of that, due to the ask today, staff was able to essentially convert two of our large pumping facilities to generator power from about 12 o'clock till 6 or 7 this evening. Those were the Rio Vista Intake Pumping Station and the Sand Canyon Pump Station. So those facilities helped in that regard. At most of our other operational or distribution facilities, instead of generators, we just looked to see what we could do to shed load. So we primarily had facilities that were filling tanks as best we could early in the day, so that by the time 3 or 4 o'clock came around, the tanks were generally full or full enough. And we ended up shutting off over 60 facilities during that time period, most of which are probably going back online about now. So the lights dim, that's us turning the switch back on. So staff is able to do things like that to assist in these times. We also tomorrow have received notice of a demand alert situation from one of our demand response programs. And we will have about 100 facilities that we will try to schedule offline for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours based on the time periods that they're asking. Aside from that, which is on the operational side, I just wanted to point out that our communications team with Kathy Martin, they're busy sending out notices and updates to the community, letting the community know what the community can do in this regard and what we're doing. And they're also sending out notices to staff, just to remind staff as ordinary people that, you know, when you get home, don't run your appliances until after 9, things like that. So that's just a brief update, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's, are you complete your report, Mr. Stone and Mr. Abercrombie?
Yes.
Before we open up the board discussion, I'd just like to ask if there are any public comments.
There is not.
Okay, very good. Director Gutzak, go ahead.
Super quick question on the demand response. Is there a financial incentive for that? I think private sector gets some.
There are. Financial, most of our demand response programs have certain demand incentives that are based on rolling averages of what our demands are and so many dollars per kilowatt hour and so forth.
So that scrubs off our bill, basically, or we get a rebate either.
Some of them that are directly with Edison are part of the bill cycle with Edison. Some of the other ones are not Edison related, really. So they're a separate a payment that would be made, I think, quarterly or every 6 months.
Okay, thank you. Great.
Any other questions for Mr. Stone or Mr. Abercrombie? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Stone. Thank you, Mr. Abercrombie. And before we go on, I'd just like to remind the board that we are well past our witching hour. So if we can just move things along quickly, I would like to finish the agenda. Move on to item 10, committee meeting recap reports for informational purposes only. There are 3 reports in your packet. If you have any questions for the board chair or for the staff on any of those committee reports, now's the time to ask. Hopefully you can do it offline. Seeing none, do we have any public comment on the reports that are in the packet, Madam Secretary?
We do not.
Very good. We move on to item 11, written reports for informational purposes only. There are five reports in your packet. Once again, are there any questions for the Director Armitage? Go ahead.
Thank you. Just real quick for the Water Resources and Outreach section report, I just had a couple questions and comments. The customer survey that was done for the conservation communication study, maybe in the next Water Resources and Watershed Committee meeting, someone can share how the participants were selected. I'd be interested to kind of learn a little bit more about that. And then similarly for the lawn replacement program initiative, the stakeholder advisory meetings, I'd be interested in learning a little bit about what you all learned from those conversations too. And then let's see, I was glad to see that there will be some participation in the KHITS DC trip. Is that staff or board members going to that? Okay.
Hi, President Martin, if you want me to answer that, I can
go ahead. Yes. That.
Yeah. Right now, it's myself and President Martin.
Okay. All right. Thanks. And then lastly, under community events, you talked about the River Rally and the Cast for Kids. For the River Rally, I think last time we talked about how we were trying to get away from giving out water bottles and instead having the refill station. Has there been progress made on that? Is that going to be available, I guess, this year is what I'm asking for the River Rally. And that's it. Thanks.
On the last item, I'll follow up with you, Director Armitage, on that one. I know a lot of it depends on the access that our refill actual station needs a water connection, a portable water connection. So a lot of the time it depends on where the event is actually held. So we'll make sure that if there is access to water, that that's available, but I'll follow up and check in with Kathy on that.
Vice President Osaski.
Okay. To piggyback on Director Armitage's comments on water resources meeting on page 309, regarding Gold SEM, it looks like a model is running and operational. Is that correct?
Yes, the model is running. I would consider it going through its testing phase. So basically just making sure that it is producing quality data and output.
Could the team provide us the .gsp file, the Gold Player SIM file, when the final testing is over?
You've gone past my knowledge, but okay. I will ask.
I'll provide an email to Dirk and to you. But I believe I and Dr. Armitage will be really interested in seeing that. I'll provide more detail later.
Great, thank you.
And then regarding the staff collaboration with Provost and Pritchard and Thomas and Harder with Devil's Den property, are we also exploring using groundwater as a cooling water for any future technological endeavors that we might install or construct on that property? Is that part of the analysis?
Currently, no, but I'd be happy to talk to you about that offline and get your thoughts on it.
Okay. All right. That's it for me. Thank you, President Martin.
Any other questions on the reports on item 11? Do we have any public comment, April?
On item 11?
We do not.
Thank you. Then we can move on to item 12, and I will try to be quick. President's report, update on board on items coming up in the near future. The 2022 Economic Outlook Conference will be on September 9th at College of the Candidate at 8 a.m. Ungodly hour, but there it is, 8 a.m. The Aqua Region 8 program September 19th of 2022 at the Burbank Water and Power from 10:30 to 3:30. If you haven't signed up, please do and support our Vice Chair of Region 8, Director Cooper. The City of Santa Clarita State of the City will be on October 27th held at the Canyon Country Community Center at 3:00. The Via Bash will be on November 4th, 2022, 6 p.m. at the Hyatt. The Aqua 2022 Fall Conference is being held in Indian Wells from November 29th through December 1. Upcoming board meetings, the regular board meeting on September 20 and a special board meeting on September 30. The September 20 meeting will be at 6. The September 30 meeting will be at 7:30 a.m. Upcoming committee meetings for the month of July held at some for the month of July. I think that's So it's the September meeting, September 14th, Water Resources Committee meeting will be held at 5:30. And the September 15th, the Public Outreach Committee meeting will be at 5:30. Upcoming committee meetings for the, those two meetings were at Summit Circle. This committee meeting, the Finance Committee meeting, the next one, September 19th at Rio Vista. And that concludes the President's report. Any public comment, April?
No.
Very good. And reminder to the board, April will send out the report. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So we can move on to item 13, AB 1234 reports. There are a number in your packet. Do we have any other AB 1234? Director Cooper.
August 31st, I attended the Aqua Region 8 Zoom meeting, putting together we're due this time to put on a program at the fall conference. So we're putting together that program for her.
Good. Director Armitage.
Thank you. August 17th, I attended a Special District Association of North LA County Executive Board meeting where we discussed plans for the next general membership meeting, and details will be coming or be put out in the near future. And then today I attended my virtual one-on-one with General Manager Stone, during which we mostly spoke about stormwater capture and then circled back to that eventually after many tangential discussions. So thank you.
Director Armitage, was a Zoom for the August 17th, just to verify?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, that was virtual. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vice President Ozahowski.
On August 17th, I attended the 7th Annual California Water Data Summit. I attended peer taught seminars on how to use RStudio to interpret Excel data and visualization issues from AMI meters. On the 31st, I had my director one-on-one virtual meeting with General Manager Matt Stone. We discussed our agency's partnerships with other California water agencies. And April, I'll send you that description by email. Back to you, President Martin.
Very good. Any other AB 1234s?
President Martin, Director Kelly has his hand up.
Director Kelly, somewhere in cyberspace.
That's where I feel like sometimes. On August 9th and August 30th, as well as the final one will be tomorrow, the Aqua Business Development Committee has a subcommittee that I'm on, which is the ACE subcommittee. ACE standing for Aqua Certification of Excellence. And we've been putting together policies and procedures on how to select the individuals that would qualify for this. We narrowed it down to 5 major policy topics, and then we're prioritizing them. So both of those, like I said, they were both done by Zoom, April, and August 9th, August 30th, and next one is tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Kelly. Any other AB 1234s? Seeing none, no public comment, I expect?
No.
Thank you very much. Item 14, director reports. Are there any director reports tonight? Director Armitage.
Thank you. I attended the listening session that General Manager Stone just spoke about in his report. About the proposed treatment facility in the Bridgeport community last week. And I just want to say thank you to all the staff that attended and helped plan for that. It was really great to hear the questions and the concerns by the community members. And I think it was really important for them to be heard. So I was glad that opportunity was offered. And I know that's going to be offered one more time, and hopefully we'll get some good attendance at that one as well. I just want to promote one of the events that I just saw go out on social media today. It's a teen financial workshop that I see that we're sponsoring and going to have a table at. And if I remember correctly, I think Kathy Martin said we were going to have a table that taught people how, or the younger kids, how to read their water bill. Is that right? I think that's fantastic. And I think that's awesome. So I want to make sure we like promote that and get that out there, because such a great way for, I think, kids and their parents to understand how to read their water bill. So yay for that. And then I just want to say thank you to everybody, to all staff and administration, for all the hard work that you do on a day-to-day basis, and especially to the field staff who are outdoors working throughout the heat of this really bad heat wave. So thank you to all of them.
Thank you, Director Armitage. Any other director reports? Seeing none, we got any? Was there a public comment on that, April?
No, there is not.
Very good. We go to item 15, director requests for approval for event attendance. Are there any requests for event attendance? Seeing none, we have arrived at item 16, adjournment. Thank you all for your patience and sticking to it tonight. Wasn't easy, but we got through it, and I appreciate everybody's participation. And here we are adjourned. Thank you, staff.